You take a seed, you plant it, you grow it, you dry it, you roll it, you smoke it, and it goes down smooth. Hey!
Spanning the globe to bring you the latest developments in medical cannabis, adult marijuana, industrial hemp, and spiritual ganja. We love the earth. It's time for the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville. Now, here's your host, Russ Belville.
Good day, tokers and tokettes and non-toking lovers of liberty. It is Friday, July 7th, 2017, and it's got to be 420 somewhere in the world. Welcome to the program and welcome to the weekend. And I know some of you out there listening are going to go see that Spider-Man Homecoming movie, the newest one in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, bringing Spider-Man back into the Marvel fold. That's way too geeky. We don't want to get into that geek level. We'll save that for hour two. But in hour one today, we've got an amazing show for you when it comes to drug law reform. In our drug policy reform update, we've got a very intriguing panel from White Faces Black Lives, a presentation that the Drug Policy Alliance put on last year, and two speakers, David Hertzberg and Helena Hansen, who are speaking about racism and white drug exceptionalism. It's fascinating talk. That's coming up first. Then in our middle segment, our Reefer Rock Review, we've got Herb Thrasher from 420 Radio stopping by to tell us all about the upcoming String Summit here in the Northwest out at Horning's Hideout. Great bluegrass music going on there. Then in our UK Cannabis Chronicle, we hear from Greg DeHoe, the chairman of the UK Cannabis Social Clubs, on his experience as a Crohn's patient traveling through four U.S. medical marijuana states. We'll cap things off with a radical rant where I ask, hey, where's the hemp-derived THC oil, huh?
You're listening to the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
Looking for the 420 friendliest way to visit beautiful legal Potland, Oregon?
I'm Lori Duckworth, inviting you to come stay with us at Delta 9 House and Studios.
You get your own private room with queen bed and access to our high-speed Wi-Fi, premium entertainment system, and more.
We'll even cook you breakfast. Look us up on Facebook at Delta 9 House.
That's facebook.com/Delta9House.
Delta 9 House is booked through Airbnb.com. City of Portland permit number 17-159855.
This November, whether you see the words medical marijuana on your ballot or not, the issue is there. From the halls of Congress to your state capitol or city hall, politicians are already making decisions on medical marijuana policy on your behalf. This election, make sure they are representing you. Every vote is a vote for medical marijuana.
Visit votemedicalmarijuana.org today.
The Marijuana Agenda. Like the liberal agenda, but with profits. Ka-ching.
Hi, I'm Russ Belville from The Marijuana Agenda. Putting together the most comprehensive live weekday marijuana news talk program is a full-time job. Now you can do your part to ensure that listener-supported independent cannabis radio journalism can continue by becoming a patron of The Marijuana Agenda. Just log on to MJAgenda.com and click the Become a Patron button. For your $4.20 monthly donation, you'll receive over 20 hours of original first-hour podcasts, plus other materials only available to paid subscribers. Or for just $9.99 a month, become a VIP patron. You'll get over 40 hours of podcasts for the complete program, including Toker Talk Radio, plus ad-free downloads of the segments heard on the Marijuana Agenda. Plus, VIPs get exclusive access to the video replay of the two-hour live stream show and downloads of the spreadsheets and charts I provide from my years of curating marijuana data sets. Thank you for your support, and remember, I cannot do it without you. Please become a patron today at MJAgenda.com.
This is your cannabis headline news. Brought to you by MarijuanaMoment.net, the complete source for all your marijuana news in one morning newsletter from Marijuana Majority founder Tom Angel. Subscribe today for free at MarijuanaMoment.net.
This is your cannabis headline news for Friday, July 7th, 2017. I'm Russ Belville. CBS reports that Nevada's first 4 days of legal recreational marijuana sales produced $3 million in sales revenue and about $500,000 in tax revenue, according to the Nevada Dispensary Association. These figures put the Silver State on track to generate an estimated $30 million in recreational marijuana sales revenue throughout the next 6 months, according to the association. The estimate was made by monitoring a period beginning with Saturday's first day of recreational marijuana sales and ending on Tuesday, July 4th. Depending on local regulations, Nevada's tax rate for recreational pot ranges between 33 and 38%, with all state and local taxes included. Thousands of shoppers waited in line for as long as 3 hours at marijuana dispensaries over the weekend for their first chance to legally purchase pot in Nevada. University of Maryland School of Pharmacy will begin offering training to prepare prospective workers for the medical marijuana industry, according to the Baltimore Sun. The move puts the Baltimore School in league with few other established universities and colleges, including the University of Vermont College of Medicine's Department of Pharmacology, seeking to bring educational standards to a growing national industry that grapples with evolving science and uncertain legal standing. The pharmacy school will offer classes through its online platform toward certifications required under the state's medical marijuana law for those involved in the business. It's partnering with the advocacy group Americans for Safe Access on the certification program. That organization will provide the instructors and the curriculum, which the school vetted and adjusted. The pharmacy school's partnership with Americans for Safe Access gives the nonprofit advocacy group, quote, immediate legitimacy for its courses, end quote, said Shad Ewert, a professor at Anne Arundel Community College, who teaches a course about the marijuana industry for credit, but not yet industry certification. In New Jersey, Philip D. Murphy, the Democratic candidate for governor and the early favorite in recent polling for November's general election, announced his unambiguous support for making recreational marijuana use legal, reports the New York Times. The $6 billion nationwide cannabis industry has since aggressively accelerated its efforts in New Jersey. While his Republican opponent, Lieutenant Governor Kim Guadagno, opposes legalization, a coalition of lobbyists, out-of-state companies, existing medical marijuana dispensaries, and even marijuana app companies are eagerly anticipating Mr. Murphy's possible election as New Jersey's next governor and are working with lawmakers in the democratically controlled legislature to have a bill ready for him to sign. In the 8 states that have legalized marijuana, over $82 million has been spent on advocacy both for and against, according to Jeff Brindle, the executive director of the New Jersey Election Law Enforcement Commission. Mr. Brindle wrote in an op-ed that he expected more industry money to flood New Jersey politics. In a story from KUNC Colorado, a marijuana credit union has won a small victory in its quest to provide banking services to pot businesses. The 10th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals vacated a lower court's ruling regarding a credit union called Fourth Corner. According to Alicia Wallace, the national marijuana policy and business reporter for The Cannabist, Fourth Corner submitted an application with the state, and it was approved, giving the potential credit union a routing number. When the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City denied their account, Fourth Corner sued, but a district judge dismissed it with prejudice. Fourth Corner appealed, and the 10th Circuit Court sent the case back to the lower court with instructions to dismiss the amended complaint without prejudice, so they can apply again, and if denied, take the case back to court. The Alaska Dispatch News reports that some state marijuana shops have suddenly found themselves with one less outlet for marijuana advertising this week. Owners and employees of at least 6 retail marijuana stores in the state said that within the past week, their Facebook pages were either taken down or entirely deleted by the tech company. The timing of the Facebook page removal seemed odd to some people in the local marijuana industry as well. The pages went dark around the same time Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg was visiting Alaska for the 4th of July weekend. This has been your Cannabis Headline News for Friday, July 7th, 2017. I'm Russ Belville.
You're listening to The Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
At Herbie's Cannabis Seeds, we pride ourselves on bringing you the best quality seeds from the world's most respected cannabis seed producers, all at the lowest online prices. You can find Herbie's Seeds at herbiesheadshop.com. All cannabis seeds are sold as souvenirs and as a means of preserving cannabis genetics. Herbie's Seeds in no way intends to condone, promote, or incite the use of illegal or controlled substances. We strongly urge all respected customers to check their national laws prior to placing an order. Herbie's Seeds at herbiesheadshop.com. Proud sponsors of the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
I'm Russ Belville from The Marijuana Agenda. Join me every 4 weeks for the Freedom Leaf Preview with Steve Bloom from Freedom Leaf Magazine. Learn more at mjagenda.com/about.
You're listening to the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
If you work in the cannabis industry, consume marijuana, or just support freedom, you need to know about breaking policy news that affects you. Marijuana Moment is the daily newsletter that helps you stay on top of all the latest and most important state, federal, and international cannabis developments. Brought to you by longtime legalization activist Tom Angel, Marijuana Moment puts a concise yet comprehensive overview of cannabis news in your inbox early every weekday morning. Wake up to Marijuana Moment and rest assured you'll be ready for the cannabis news that's driving the day. Subscribe now at marijuanamoment.net.
This is the Drug Policy Reform Update, brought to you by Drug Policy Alliance at drugpolicy.org. The war on marijuana is just one aspect of the global drug war that corrupts governments, enriches criminals, and imprisons consumers. While marijuana may be safer, that doesn't mean that other substances should be criminalized. Learn why legalizing all drugs should be every cannabis reformer's goal in this edition of the Drug Policy Reform Update. Welcome to the Drug Policy Reform Update. I'm Russ Belville. Drug Policy Alliance held a seminar at Columbia University entitled White Faces, Black Lives. Today, we feature highlights from a panel entitled Racism and Its Role in White Drug Exceptionalism, moderated by Samuel K. Roberts of Columbia University. Today, we feature two panelists, David Hertzberg from the University of Buffalo and Helena Hansen from New York University.
I think that there are, as a historian, there are three ways that belief in the ideology of whiteness has done damage in relation to drugs and drug practices. The first relates to drug policy. First wave of widespread drug harm in America took place in the late 19th century. And it's important to understand why. This was a time of industrial revolution, growing consumer markets. People were using all different kinds of consumer goods, more shirts, more cars, more books, more candles, more forks, and more drugs, because they were more widely available for the same reason that all other goods were more widely available. With more use came more of the harms associated with drug use. And as those harms expanded dramatically, social authority said, we have a problem, we want to respond to this problem. But they responded to the problem in two different ways because they saw two different kinds of problems, these mostly white authorities. They saw white native-born middle-class men, and especially women, buying their drugs through the medical system with the advice of a doctor from a pharmacist. And they saw these people as innocent victims. If they experienced drug harm, such as addiction, they saw them as innocent victims of broad social forces beyond their control. So an out-of-control drug industry, ignorant, poorly educated doctors, or the stresses of living in a time of rapid economic change. So they responded to these drug victims with consumer protections. They regulated the drug industry, they regulated medical practice, and they created mechanisms to allow continued provision of drugs to people who had become addicted through the medical system over the next half century. Meanwhile, working class immigrant and non-whites, mostly men in cities, who had less access to the medical system and tended to be purchasing their drugs in a different way, still legal. There were no anti-drug laws this time, still legal. They saw this group of people as willful deviants who were criminals because of their innate racial capacities, because their innate character flaws. And so they passed the law you heard of before, the Harrison Anti-Narcotic Act in 1914, to outlaw them and arrest them. By the mid-1920s, drug violators were 30% of America's federal prisoners. That's 100 years, almost 100 years ago. So when you look at this first response, you see these white middle classes in the medical system got a response that bears some elements of what we call harm reduction. You got regulated availability with a focus on the safety of end consumers, and you had drug maintenance for people who had become addicted. How well did this work? Well, slowly over about half a century, drug harms related to medical provision of opioids and cocaine, it went down. It did work slowly to reduce the harm associated with drug use in that context. But these other populations, these immigrants, non-whites, their numbers, the numbers of drug harm related to their use did not go down. Just punishing them and locking them up, big surprise, was not effective. So the first harm of whiteness, I would say, is that it helped prevent good policy from being applied widely, because they looked at this policy, looked at its success, and said, well, that success is due to the qualities of the white people that we gave it to. It's not a success based on the policy itself. That was something special about white people that made that policy work for them. So that's the first harm. The second harm has to do with drug harms and especially addiction. These policies that were oriented towards white drug users, they helped them, but they also hid them. When people studied drug problems in the 1920s, they thought a lot of the white drug users had disappeared because they weren't showing up in jails, they weren't showing up in hospitals because they were being taken care of in a different way. And so addiction came to be ever more closely associated with these urban populations, sometimes called the dangerous classes by these reformers and authorities. So what this meant is that the ability to see and recognize drug harms among those white middle-class populations was reduced. And when drug companies and physicians came up with new drugs to replace the ones that had been so tightly regulated, talking about barbiturate sedatives and amphetamine stimulants, these were very lightly regulated because they were being used in the medical system where addiction had supposedly disappeared. Those white people didn't want to be addicted, so they were making good decisions, right? So unsurprisingly, these drugs became massively widely used in America starting in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s. The overwhelming majority of people who were using psychoactive drugs in America during these decades were white middle-class people using barbiturates and amphetamines. These drugs have risks associated with them, and a very large and significant problems with drug dependence and drug overdose were associated with these drugs. Just to give a quick example, 1953, the overdose rate for barbiturates was nearly 8 per 100,000. To give a point of comparison, in 2013, the overdose rate for prescription opioids was almost 5 per 100,000. So this was a genuine public health crisis taking place right in the teeth of a supposed drug war with drugs that were being widely advertised everywhere you looked and widely used. So this is a second harm of whiteness in this story. It made the risks of so-called white drugs, if you're a drug company and you can have your drug be considered white, it makes it that much harder to have it be regulated with the consumer protections that can limit the kind of harms and risks that can come along with widespread use. So that's the second harm. Third and last harm relates to drug benefits, not drug harms, but drug benefits. Once you add in pharmaceuticals, sedatives, stimulants, and narcotics to the story of drugs in American history, the idea of there being a drug war kind of recedes a little bit. And you look at a tale whose overwhelmingly dominant numbers are about the promotion and encouragement of drug use, because these drugs can produce benefits to people. Sedatives, stimulants, and narcotics are important drugs that the U.S. government has clearly, throughout this entire period, decided should be used and should be widely used. So instead, what you see, instead of a drug war, you see what might best be characterized as a segregated consumer market for drugs, just like you had a segregated consumer market for houses and movie theaters and amusement parks, etc. You have one, whites are invited to participate in a consumer market called pharmaceuticals. These are of drugs that are relatively well regulated. You know what is in them. They are provided by actors who, at least in theory, share the goal of the well-being of the end consumers in that market. And meanwhile, non-whites have less privileged access to that system and have easier access to a totally unregulated drug market, providing drugs of unknown provenance, where if they run into drug harm, instead of being taken care of as the ones in that the white half of this kind of Jim Crow drug provision system get, they are punished because they become visible. When you experience a drug harm, you become visible and you actually get punished and suffer further harm. So that's the third harm that whiteness perpetrated in the system, is that it has actually helped restrict access to the benefits of drugs. It's important to remember that there's a reason why these drugs are widely used and are the basis of, you know, one of America's biggest industries.
Great, thanks. Helena?
Thank you. So we are now in the era of the endangered white American, with the media lamenting the decline in life expectancy among white men and women, largely due to opioid overdose, right? That's the leading cause. In this one instance, racism seems to be protective of non-whites because they're less often offered opioid painkillers. But the lesser-known story behind the whiteness of opioid overdose, as well as the pharmaceuticalized government response to white overdose, is the way that whiteness has been used to relax narcotic regulations, to ethnically target less stigmatized white markets, and to biologize addiction in ways that mask the social and economic conditions surrounding drug use. So I'm going to give you a quick racial biography because Jesse gave me 5 minutes. A quick racial biography of three key opioids based on my last 10 years of research on opioids and race, something that really hit me over the head in my practice as an addiction psychiatrist and as a cultural anthropologist. The first drug is OxyContin. So it's FDA approval in 1996 as a quote-unquote minimally addictive pain reliever. It was based on a three-month-long clinical trial among terminal cancer patients that failed to account for real-world social conditions of its use, such as the ease with which the sustained-release capsules could be crushed and injected or snorted. Purdue Pharmaceuticals then had license to hire almost 700 drug reps to canvass general doctors in largely white areas of states, like largely white suburban and rural America, including states like Maine, Kentucky, and Ohio, which led to a tenfold increase in prescriptions for opioid pain relievers. So this aggressive marketing was possible largely because of the white identity of the anticipated opioid consumer. The second drug that I want to give a biography for is buprenorphine, otherwise known as Suboxone, and you already heard that drug mentioned this morning in the Q&A. As a maintenance treatment for opioid addiction, it has become the primary governmental response to overdose, along with naloxone overdose reversal kits. Congress specifically legalized it for private office treatment of opioid dependents in the year 2000, out of concern for the growing numbers of, quote, and here I'm quoting the congressional record, suburban youth not appropriate for methadone. So in doing so, Congress reversed 86 years of prohibition against physicians using opioids to treat opioid addiction that is outside of stigmatized methadone clinics that are DEA regulated and require daily observed dosing. Bear in mind that methadone clinics were introduced by Nixon as the first weapon in the war on drugs during the black and brown urban heroin crisis of the 1970s. And that's really why they're largely located in poor black and brown neighborhoods. So in contrast, in the 1990s, the National Institute on Drug Abuse allotted $27 million for clinical trials of Suboxone as an office-based treatment for addiction. Congress designated Suboxone an orphan drug in order to extend the patent protection for Suboxone an additional 10 years and worked with the manufacturer to develop an 8-hour certification requirement for doctors who want to prescribe Suboxone, which helped to limit Suboxone to the private and therefore largely white sector. Okay, the third drug to offer a biography for is heroin, which is now recapturing its whiteness due to a crisis of blame. Since white opioid-addicted people are not politically acceptable targets for arrest, our government's response has been directed at prescribers and at the drug itself. That is, with prescription drug monitoring programs that enforce physicians' participation with threats to their medical license in New York State, for example, and with the withdrawal of the original OxyContin from the market and its replacement by newly patented tamper-resistant formulations. As supplies of pills dried up, new white users turned to heroin. The majority of them are now women, given that women disproportionately see doctors for pain treatment. So we're now back to a middle-class white, we're now back to middle-class white women as the primary clientele for heroin. This replicates the 19th century demographic following Bayer Pharmaceuticals' introduction of heroin to the market in 1898 as a non-addictive treatment for morphine addiction, which was widespread among Victorian housewives. And this demographic, in turn, now in 2016, is inspiring bipartisan calls to enhance funding for addiction treatment and to begin to decriminalize heroin use. So what these biographies teach us is that whiteness is a powerful instrument of biocapital. It works by not naming whiteness, and I heard someone calling out when I cited the congressional record, suburban white youth. Yes, that's a code language for white. So it uses coded language, such as suburban and mainstream America. Pharma and biotech make up the single largest industry in the world, and the U.S. consumes 80% of the world's opioid supply. Bear in mind that we make up less than 5% of the world's population. Whiteness is a major driver for opening otherwise stigmatized and outlawed markets, with newly patented narcotics netting in the billions of dollars. Whiteness is an industrial strategy, a cloaking device that lures white America to pay for dangerous drugs at inflated, patented prices, but also with their lives.
This episode was produced as part of the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville, the daily news and interview podcast covering the world of medical cannabis, adult marijuana, industrial hemp, and spiritual ganja. MJAgenda.com.
Hi, I'm Russ Belville from the Marijuana Agenda. Putting together the most comprehensive live weekday marijuana news talk program is a full-time job. Now you can do your part to ensure that listener-supported independent cannabis radio journalism can continue by becoming a patron of the Marijuana Agenda. Just log on to MJAgenda.com and click the Become a Patron button. If you're an organization or business looking to promote your brand, we have sponsorship patronage available at MJAgenda.com. Sponsorship includes 15 and 30 second ad breaks and 6 minute interviews on the podcast, depending on sponsorship level, which begins at $19.99 a month. Thank you for your support, and remember, I cannot do it without you. Please become a patron today at MJAgenda.com.
Georgia. Hi, this is Willie Nelson. Alcohol prohibition didn't work in the 1920s, and marijuana prohibition isn't working today. It's time we stopped arresting responsible marijuana smokers. It's the fair thing to do.
For more information, contact NORML, the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. Call toll-free 888-67-NORML or visit their website at norml.org.
The Marijuana Agenda, like the conservative agenda, minus the hypocrisy.
New beginner guitars and banjos are often constructed much better than ones built before your time. Why struggle? Get a new instrument or fix the old one. The trusted professionals at the Fingerboard Extension will evaluate your instrument for free. Repairs are priced for people who work for a living. Stop by the Fingerboard Extension, downtown Corvallis at 120 Northwest 2nd Street today, or check out its inventory on the web at fingerboardextension.com.
As we prepare for the weekend, we remember that the fight to end adult marijuana prohibition is as much about culture as it is about criminal justice. Music has always been at the forefront of revolution, and the marijuana movement is no different. Join us as we visit with Herb Thrasher, program manager at 420radio.org, for this edition of Reefer Rock Review.
All right, folks, we made it to the end of the week, and that means it's time for us to let our hair down and join up with 420 Radio's Herb Thrasher, who's going to give us our Reefer Rock Review for the day. Herb, welcome to the weekend. How's it going?
Right on. Thanks so much. Doing great. Lots of things happening. Less than a week till the Northwest String Summit happening here in legalized Portland, Oregon. Happens to be July 13th through the 16th, coming up right around the bend. Lots of great bands. 420 Radio will be out there. We'll be out on the grounds. Got a photo pass, an auto access pass. So we'll be discussing a lot of things with these artists and taking some great pictures. Again, it's held at Horning's Hideout. Many great bands playing, like Yonder Mountain String Band playing three sets, Green Sky Bluegrass playing two sets. The Del McCurry Band's going to be there. Elephant Revival will be there. This year we have a new artist to the lineup, Todd Snyder. Real excited to see him. Portland's Fruition. A lot of great bands. We'll also be seeing, got the Test Apes. Looking forward to seeing them. That's Danny Barnes, banjo picker, meeting Max Brody, ex-drummer for Ministry, and those two have put together a weird kind of punkadelic kind of bluegrass, so we'll be getting all kinds of things. There's a funk band on the Saturday night late set, Turquoise, and so looking forward to many great things, a lot of camping. The festival's Thursday through Sunday, July 13th through 16th. You can go to the stringsummit.com. There's still tickets left. You can hear an interview that I had with the festival director, Sky McDonald, tonight on Herb Thrasher Flower Hour at 8 p.m. on 420 Radio. And you can also go to the Facebook page and find the link for that festival as well. And speaking of music that's going to be at that festival, we got a brand new release. The band is going to be playing late Thursday night set. Really looking forward to seeing Split Lip Rayfield, who just released their brand new album, On My Way. These guys are from Kansas, and it's a full-length album, a little over, got 10 songs on it, and these guys have been going for quite a while, kind of regrouped, and have got their strings back in gear, kind of known as Thrashgrass, as they mix this up, got a speedier kind of vibe to their bluegrass tendencies, and they're playing again, late-night set, on Thursday night, just released a brand new album, On My Way, and you can go to their Bandcamp page, and you can hear this whole album stream, and also go to their website, splitliprayfield.com, and you can find out information on that and get out there and support these guys as well. And one more story real quick. Stoner Rock pioneers, Stoner Rock legends, Black Sabbath has announced September 28th, as the end of the end. We'll be filming, they filmed their February Birmingham final concert, and it's going to be playing in over 1,500 cinemas worldwide and adding more as it is. But it's kind of like a documentary, and this will, the whole tour has been going on for about 2 years now as far as the end, and this will mark the end, the end. And according to Ozzy Osbourne, there won't be any coming back. No matter what, 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road, they're saying the end is the end. And if you're not familiar with Black Sabbath, you should be. They have the greatest stoner rock song of all time, Sweetleaf. So I'll be in a cinema, not sure where, but I'll be posting all the cinemas and information as that as well. So follow 420 Radio on our Facebook page, hit us up on Twitter, and check out our live shows tonight, 8 p.m. Herb Thrasher Flower Hour, followed by 10 p.m. Big Daddy Fink's Funky Roller Rink. And there's your Reefer Rock Report for today.
Thanks, Herb Thrasher, and have yourself a great weekend. Everybody turn on to 420radio.org tonight at 8 p.m. Pacific time and check out 2 hours of the best live stoner rock and metal bluegrass music you could enjoy, followed by an hour of the deepest funk tracks on the internet. Herb Thrasher and 420 Radio bringing it all to you. Thanks, Herb. We'll talk to you again next week.
All right. Take care, everyone. See you next week.
This episode was produced as part of the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville, the daily news and interview podcast covering the world of medical cannabis, adult marijuana, industrial hemp, and spiritual ganja. MJAgenda.com.
It's Russ Belville from the Marijuana Agenda, inviting you to be like me and get your ink done at Lucky Horseshoe Tattoo, Fort Worth's most female-friendly, clean, sterile, awesome tattoo shop. Thomas and his crew are true artists who can design you a custom piece or use a design you bring in. Lucky Horseshoe also offers all styles of tattooing as well as piercings and all-around fun. In the DFW area, stop by Lucky Horseshoe Tattoo and tell them Radical Russ sent you. Trust me, it'll feel awesome.
Did you know that in Georgia, one in 13 adults is in jail or prison or on parole or probation? As a mother and as a professional, I advocate for access to drug treatment instead of incarceration. We need you to join us in this important fight. This October, we're coming to Atlanta for the 2017 Drug Policy Alliance Reform Conference. Come lend your voice to the fight. Register now at reformconference.org.
You're not high. You're listening to the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
I'm astonished to hear people suggest we can solve our heroin crisis. Have you heard this? By having more marijuana.
Okay, maybe you're a little high.
I'm Russ Belville with the Marijuana Agenda. Join me every 2 weeks for the Cannabis Minority Report from the Minority Cannabis Business Association. Learn more at mjagenda.com/about.
Welcome to the United Kingdom Cannabis Chronicle, brought to you by the UK Cannabis Social Clubs at ukcsc.co.uk. Your source for relaxation and reform. Today, we catch you up on the latest news and speak with an expert from the United Kingdom on the latest developments in ending adult cannabis prohibition. This is your UK Cannabis Chronicle.
What's up, guys? Welcome to Cannabis Cure TV. I just thought I'd share a story about legal medical cannabis from my travels in America. Oregon has recently legalized cannabis for recreational use, so I feel very comfortable speaking about this experience now. I'm sure Ganja John Calico are happy for me to talk about it. We've talked about it and before anyway, so it shouldn't really be an issue. We've done so online, but on my travels throughout America in 2011, I went to Colorado, Washington, Oregon, and California, and checked out their legal medical cannabis situations. They've all got some kind of exemption in the law for if you're a patient and you've got a qualifying condition, or in California, anything goes condition, you can have a certain amount of cannabis on you. You can consume it at home or in certain public places, and even grow a certain number of plants. Now, I was with one such patient, Ganda John. He has had, I think he's on his fourth kidney now. He's got one eye. He's on medications that he will be on for the rest of his life, some like immunosuppressants, and he does use cannabis on top of that as well. I think he was on dialysis for 18 months for the period of life that I met him. I think it was that long. It might not have been quite that long, but it was an incredibly long time. And his body would not really have been able to take that kind of treatment had it not been for the cannabis that he used. And he used a hell of a lot of cannabis, and he still does. And he gave me some great advice once when I was desperately ill. And he said, "Greg, just, you know, use more cannabis." And I said, "I don't think I possibly can." And he said, "Greg, you can. Just, you're just going to have to do it." And I said, "All right, okay." And I did it, and I'm here to tell the story. So anyway, we were in Oregon. We were driving down from a legal cannabis trim job that I'd just done with a group of friends. It was a ChemDoc trim, and it was stinky, and it absolutely reeked of fuel, like that really like ChemDoc diesel-y smell, absolutely all over us. Each one of us, me, Kalika, and John, were wearing cannabis clothing, all made by handmade apparel, actually. We noted afterwards I had a Token Daily t-shirt on, Ganja John had a Live It Like It's Legal t-shirt on, and I think Kalika probably had a normal t-shirt on, because at the time we were working for Normal Show Live with Radical Russ. So driving down from one part of sort of North Oregon down to South Oregon, I think we were going to around Eugene to stay with Ganja John's parents, and we've gone into a convenience store about 11 o'clock at night, maybe midnight, and just looking around for snacks as you do when you've been trimming all day, and and dabbing and vaping and smoking and you know, enjoying good company. We've done a hard day's work. We've been trimming for 8 hours, so we went to stock up on food before we got back to his parents' place for the night. And while we're in there, John bumps into an old school friend, and he's talking to her, and he's saying, "Oh, well, you know, I haven't seen you for so long. What are you up to?" And John says, "I'm just on my way down to California. We're gonna go and see some friends. I'm taking my friend here to meet them, meaning me." And he said, "We're just, you know, just gonna hang out for a few days." And as that happened, two police officers happened to walk through the door. And they heard California and began to John with "Live it like it's legal" written on there, and a big weed leaf, and probably a weed leaf on his hat. And admittedly, we did smell quite a bit. They've sort of like lingered around the store, sort of like, I've walked out of there, I've just been like, "Oh my god, I don't like this situation." I'm going to go back to the car. So I went back to the car, all three of us, walked out, and as we got into the car, the officers walked out of the store and flicked their flashlight on the car, and were like, "Don't move, stay in the vehicle," and we were kind of apprehended at that point. They came over to it, two big cops in their beige uniforms, and they wanted to search us. They said it smelled like we had 10 pounds of marijuana on us, and they needed to search our vehicle. And they heard that we'd been to California, and Gander John is just like not laughing, but sort of like, I can sense that he's sort of going, "Oh my god, this is ridiculous." You know, he's like, "I'm a medical marijuana patient. I have a card." He said, I'm registered. I have these, you know, I have these conditions." He said, "We're not going down we're not coming back from California." I said, "We're actually going down to California. And anyway, who the hell wants to smuggle 10 pounds of cannabis into California? Don't you know how much they grow there?" And this guy didn't quite like the wiseness of John. He wasn't being aggressive or, you know, too snarky at all, but it was just an obvious fact. You know, who does want to grow cannabis in Oregon and then smuggle it through the Emerald Triangle, where they grow, you know, some of the best and the largest quantities of cannabis, you know, that gets shipped around the whole of the United States. And not just the state, and that's been happening since the 60s and 70s when the hippies really settled up there. So John's given them this information. They're looking at his thing. They've pulled Calico out, and one of the officers actually leant through the car and goes, "You get out. You smell the worst." And it was clearly a racist shot. Calico is Mexican Hawaiian, and they pulled him out, and they patted him down and searched him, and they're asking him questions, which he answered, truthfully and carefully, and just said as much as he needed to say, which was all he needed to say. He wasn't carrying any cannabis. He didn't actually have any there wasn't any real probable cause, and to point out that he smelt the worst was just a little bit strange, considering when we actually left. I'll fill you in on that bit in a minute. I managed to get away completely unspoken to in the whole situation. I think I was there luckily just left on my own, pulled out the car. They've searched the car. I just sat down on a wall and just watched it all unfold, really. Like, I had Calico to my left and John to my right. During the raid, another two police cars pulled over. It must have been donut hour or something at the shop, and the hot fresh ones just came out of the oven, and two or three city police came out, and they were like, "Oh, do you need a hand, guys?" And we were like, "Oh my god, you know, this is crazy." What they found in the car, they found my Sheldon Black bong in the back, in the case. They pulled it out. There was 1 gram of Jack the Ripper in there that the guys at Borafon gave me. And it was the pink lemonade car, so it smelled absolutely fire. And I remember seeing the guy pull it. I was looking at it and going, "Oh, please don't drop my bong. Please don't drop my bong." And he pulled it out, pulled this little tiny little bag, you know, just a kitchen bag with a gram of Jack the Ripper bud in it. And he sort of like looked at it and smelt it and put it back in there, because it's not a large amount, and John had already presented his medical marijuana card. It wasn't an issue. He put it back in there. They were looking for signs or for weight or anything like that, and they didn't find any, and they were very disappointed. They let us go. They didn't make it. I don't think they gave any record of his of the search to John or anything like that, and we were on our way, and it was a pretty scary experience, to be honest. I thought, you know, if they find out I'm English, they might start interrogating me, thinking I'm some kind of international drug baron or something like that. in my dreams, it was a situation where, although medical cannabis was legal and John had access to that, and John had 10 grams of scissor hash in his pocket, which was fine. Nothing over his limit. I think you can carry 6 pounds on you in Oregon and it not be a problem. And despite that, they still had an issue with the fact that John smelt like weed and he's a patient, and that he might have a large amount of cannabis in his vehicle. And it struck me that even though you are a patient, they're going to still try and get everyone else, and patients are going to get caught in the crossfire. And I think that's something really important to remember when we're trying to fight for our rights here in the UK and the way we go about it. So one love to Ganja John and Calico out there in Oregon, and congratulations to everyone who is making their way forward in the new legal cannabis industry out there. It must be a really exciting time. I've been watching some of the progress over there, not just for the cannabis side of things, but the hemp side of things as well, because you've got the right to grow hemp legally as well now. Good watching Riot Sketch's stuff on Facebook. He's you know, on the ground, really seeing things moving as they're going on around him. I had a lot of good fun with him out in Washington, actually, when I was out there, and forever remember that time. But I'm gonna stop rambling now and let you get on with your evenings. But I just thought I'd let you have that story about patients living in an illegal medical cannabis world and how it's not quite as simple as it might seem.
This episode was produced as part of the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville, the daily news and interview podcast covering the world of medical cannabis, adult marijuana, industrial hemp, and spiritual ganja. MJAgenda.com.
The Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville is proudly sponsored by the Marijuana Business Association. The MJBA, called by NBC News the Cannabis Chamber of Commerce, is the fastest growing business association and the fastest growing industry in America. I've been working with the MJBA for years, and I personally invite you to join the MJBA. MJBA also publishes the popular MJ Headline News on Facebook and the MJNewsNetwork.com and Marijuana Channel 1 on YouTube. Visit MJBA.net for more details.
As a formerly incarcerated person, I know firsthand all the ways that we are disenfranchised when we are run through the system. Every day I work to help people regain their rights and dignity, but the fight is far from over. We need you to join us in this important fight. This October, we're coming to Atlanta for the 2017 Drug Policy Alliance Reform Conference. Join us in the fight to end the drug war. Register now at reformconference.org.
You're listening to the Marijuana Agenda with Russ Belville.
It's like I picked the wrong week to quit smoking.
Learn more at MJAgenda.com.
I'm Russ Belville from the Marijuana Agenda. Join me every 4 weeks for our Government at Work, the latest in cannabis reform at the local, state, federal, and international level. Learn more at mjagenda.com/about.
Total war against public enemy number one.
10 federal criminal penalties for up to 1 ounce of marijuana.
Marijuana is probably the most dangerous drug.
Just say no.
Legalization is just another word for surrender.
I experimented with marijuana and didn't inhale.
This is not medicine. This is a Cheech and Chong show.
Encourage people to use less drugs.
I am ill.
That was the point.
I think it would be a mistake to leave a state.
Negative reports coming out of Colorado.
Don't smoke marijuana.
Well, if you were listening yesterday, you got to hear me go off on the hemp oil hucksters, these companies that are selling CBD oil over the internet in all 50 states, claiming that our product is legal in all 50 states, completely legal, which is hard to understand then why the federal Congress has three bills before it to legalize CBD by taking it out of the Controlled Substances Act. Hard to understand why 16 states spend all that time and money holding elections to legalize CBD for epilepsy in their state if it's already federally illegal in all 50 states. But that's their argument, right? They say, hey, we're selling this CBD oil. It's legal in all 50 states. And how they put that together, how they put that legal theory together is based on a few rickety planks. And one of them is the 2004 case HIA versus DEA, the Hemp Industries Association versus the Drug Enforcement Administration. And what had happened back then is that there was hemp products like hemp seed oil, hemp foods, hemp lotions and such that the DEA in the early 2000s tried to ban. And they banned them by saying, look, this stuff has THC in it. And THC is a controlled substance. You can't have THC as an illegal drug. Even though it's in tiny, 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 tiny amounts, that's not going to get anybody high. You can't have it because it's THC and it's illegal. And the Hemp Industries Association sued. And they argue that the way that the Controlled Substances Act is written, that if you extract something from hemp, it's legal. In that the Controlled Substances Act is set up where synthetic THC is defined specifically. Tetrahydrocannabinols are specifically defined in the Controlled Substances Act. And the court ruled in favor of the Hemp Industries Association because they said, look, if the Congress put synthetic THC in there, then that doesn't mean all THC is illegal. THC that is naturally derived from substances that aren't marijuana wouldn't be illegal. Now, the problem, of course, is that THC is only found in substances that are marijuana. You get THC from marijuana flower, marijuana leaf, marijuana resin. That's considered marijuana. That's a Schedule I drug. It's completely illegal. But in the hemp industry's case, they were talking about making hemp soaps and hemp seed oil and hemp seed, you know, flour and bread and whatever else with hemp that it contained less than 0.3% THC. And when you go look at the definition of cannabis in the Controlled Substances Act, the definition of marijuana, I should say, marijuana is what they call it, and marijuana is illegal if it comes from the plant, except, and there's this very important exception, hemp stalk. Hemp stalk and hemp seed are not considered marijuana. Those are exceptions, and those are legal. Now, you can't get a hemp stalk without growing a live cannabis plant. So you can't cultivate hemp federally, right? And both living and dead plants count as marijuana. So the plants themselves are still illegal under the marijuana definition of the Controlled Substances Act. But if somebody in another country, somebody in Germany, grows some cannabis And then they just trim it down to where it's just the stalks. The stalks themselves aren't illegal, and so that's legal. That's why we got hemp products and hemp fibers and all sorts of stuff here in America. So getting back to the hemp oil guys base their theory that CBD is legal on that 2004 case. They say, well, if it's derived from a hemp stalk, then that can't be illegal. But the problem with this reasoning is that there is no synthetic CBD versus natural CBD rule going on here. All CBD, all cannabidiol is illegal because it comes from marijuana. It comes from the plant, it comes from the leaves, the flower, or the resins. The claim that you could get CBD out of seeds or stalk is dubious because there's just not enough of it in seeds and stalks to really be practical, to be possible. So their argument is like, well, we're getting this from hemp stalk, so it's legal. So stuff that comes from hemp is legal. And that opens up a brand new sort of thought that I had this morning on a simple soundbite to debunk this legal in all 50 states CBD oil. If things extracted from hemp are legal, then where is the hemp-derived THC oil that's legal in all 50 states? The logic that these hemp oil hucksters are trying to use to convince their customers that they're not breaking federal law is based on the 2004 Hemp Industries case that said, well, you're extracting stuff from hemp. If you got a shampoo or a lotion or a food that came from hemp that was less than 0.3% THC, it's legal. But less than 0.3% is not zero. It means there's still some THC there, right? So why aren't these companies getting a whole bunch of hemp seed oil like they claim to be doing, getting hemp seed oil from Northern Europe and extracting the CBD out of it? Because that would be legal because it came from hemp. If that's your excuse, then that excuse works even better for THC. Because the 2004 Hemp Industries case actually set the precedent that naturally occurring THC derived from a source other than marijuana is legal. The whole case is based on this idea that if Congress wrote synthetic THC down, then that meant non-synthetic THC, natural THC, was something that was a constituent of cannabis and was thereby illegal. That's the whole legal reasoning involved there. So if you're trying to use that as your excuse for why CBD is legal, then that's an even better excuse as to why hemp-derived THC would be legal. Why not take those big vats, these alleged vats of Northern European hemp oil that you're extracting CBD from, why not extract the THC from it? Wouldn't it be legal in all 50 states? Well, I'll tell you why they're not going to do that. Because they know in the minute they extract THC and try to use that same bullshit argument on it, the DEA is going to be seizing their equipment, seizing their bank accounts, and perp marching some people into federal prison. Because they know the DEA does really care a lot about THC and people getting high off of it. And then CBD, they don't care so much about because it doesn't get people high and it's really restricted to people using it for medical uses. And if we bust those people, it's going to make us look really bad. That's the only reason they're trying to play this wink, wink, nudge, nudge game with CBD oil and not with THC oil that would be as legal or more legal under their reasoning. They know they're breaking the law. They know they're hoodwinking their customers into thinking they're not breaking the law. And to some extent, you could say this is a cool civil disobedience in that you build up this patient base, this customer base of people all throughout the United States, even in states without CBD laws, who become dependent on this medication. They find the relief from it, that it cures their seizures, that it does such wonders for them and their kids. And then if the DEA does come and shut them down, which the indications are, it's starting to look like they're setting up the battleground for that. If they do come and shut them down, you've got enough money to build a really good case and enough public support for people to be behind it. Still, it is immoral to engage people in breaking unjust laws without them knowing that they're breaking those unjust laws.
Follow MJ Agenda on Facebook, Pinterest, Instagram, YouTube, and follow MJ Agenda Show on Twitter. Learn more at MJAgenda.com.
That's all the time we got for Hour 1. Stay tuned. Hour 2 is next, live on YouTube and podcast at MJAgenda.com. For everyone here at Delta 9 House and Studios, I'm Radical Russ, and until next time, take care of each other, tokers.
You grow it, you try it, you roll it, you smoke it, and it goes down smooth.